Well, Christ is risen. Amen. The question that we're going to explore today is this. How does what we just said become not something that we just say, but something that we live? How do we not just be people who talk about the resurrection, who believe in the doctrine of the resurrection, but how do we become resurrection people? How do we live in light of the resurrection? Because that's what Christians are, right? Christians are resurrection people. If Christ had not been raised from the dead, then the disciples would still be in there, huddled, afraid, in the room. We don't ever move on and get on to better things. The resurrection initiated the life of the church, and the resurrection sustains and animates the life of the church. This means the resurrection changes everything for us. It changes how we live. Or it ought to. We want to be resurrection people. In this passage that we're going to look at here at the end of Luke that you just heard read in Luke 24 is a story that Luke tells about how we can get in on the resurrection. It's a story that helps us become resurrection people, helps us learn to live and embrace the resurrection. What we're going to see is that resurrection living is built upon resurrection hope. That resurrection living is built upon, it's fueled by resurrection hope. And that hope is birthed in us as Jesus reveals himself to us, as the risen Christ reveals himself to us, makes himself known in the breaking of the bread. So what is that resurrection hope all about? And how can we have hope in a world in which there are so many reasons to not have hope? It probably wouldn't take us too long to think of a lot of ways that throughout our life we've been disappointed. That our expectations were not met. Maybe in some little things, but maybe in some big things. How can there be hope in a world where prayers go unanswered? How can there be hope in a world where expectations go unmet? How can there be hope in a world where there is suffering? How can there be hope when we've been disappointed and let down over and over and over again? How can there be hope when we've seen our dreams crumble in our hands? Where promises of hope and change burn out bright and fast. We have so many reasons to feel hopeless. Some of you are acutely aware of this. You're acutely aware of the reality of disappointment and loss in your life. In fact, some of us, because of our acute awareness, because we've just been hit so many times with disappointment, some of us might have abandoned hope. We might have abandoned hope and given over into despair. Given over to living fearful and anxious lives. Always needing to protect against the next time when we might get disappointed. Can you relate to that this morning? But maybe some of you can't relate to that. Maybe some of you feel really hopeful. That's a good thing. But maybe some of us aren't actually filled with hope. Maybe we're just avoiding hopelessness. It's not that we have hope. It's that we're so distracted and so numbed by entertainment and our other coping mechanisms that we haven't had to notice what's lurking at our core. In fact, some of us know very well, maybe consciously, maybe subconsciously, that if we slowed down long enough and actually entered into silence, that we would be confronted with things we don't like. That we would be confronted with despair, with that dark place where all our loss and disappointment lies. And so we keep moving so quickly and keep numbing ourselves and entertaining ourselves so we don't have to pay attention to it. That's not hope, that's just avoiding the hopelessness. Some of us have spent years consciously and unconsciously staying so busy and so entertained or so hopped up on whatever that we don't notice the despair at our core. In fact, we live in a world where often what we feel like we have to do is just keep the dust kicked up in our life. Because we know that if the dust in our life actually settles, then all that we will be left with is disappointment, suffering, or loss. Can you relate to that this morning? The bad news is that there are plenty of reasons for despair. There are plenty of reasons to be anxious and afraid and to protect ourselves from further loss. But the good news, the word of grace that speaks right into that, is that Christ is risen and God is redeeming all things. He is making all things new. That's what the resurrection is all about. And that means that suffering and disappointment and loss are part of the redemption. That means that resurrection hope is all about the ability to look at the disappointment and suffering and loss and say, yes. Yes, but Christ is risen and is redeeming all things. He's making himself known in the breaking of the bread. That kind of hope changes everything. It doesn't ignore everything. It doesn't pretend like everything's okay. It doesn't try to strive for some type of absolute certainty or some sort of absolute emotional certainty. But it changes everything. It means that suffering and disappointment and loss does not mean game over. I'm suggesting this morning that the necessary starting point for learning what resurrection hope is all about is our disappointment. When you feel disappointed and hopeless, and you will at some point, that is the beginning of resurrection hope. Because God is redeeming all things. Because Christ is risen, this is what this means. Because Christ is risen, our deepest disappointment, suffering, and loss does not need to lead to despair. It does not need to lead to despair, but that place can become the very ground where resurrection hope springs forth. The resurrected Christ is making himself known to us. The question is this: will we let him be the fulfillment of our longing? Will we let him be the fulfillment of our longing? Will we let him lead us beyond our disappointment and into resurrection hope? In Luke 24, when we come to encounter these two disciples who are a little bit disenchanted, they are ones who had not yet been transformed by the resurrection hope. They're on their way out of Jerusalem to Emmaus, and they're disappointed. They're having a discussion, and they're not just having a calm and cool, collected, scholarly discussion. They're disappointed. They had hoped, they told that stranger on the road, that Jesus would redeem all things. But now he was dead. Hopes dashed, and they were sad, Luke says. They were walking sullenly from Jerusalem to Emmaus, away from the community of disciples that had become their family, and probably back home, arguing along the way, Luke says, trying to make sense of what happened. For them, the game was over. They had lost. And they were probably asking themselves, as they were headed back home in defeat, what did we miss? What did we get wrong? What should have happened? What are we going to do now? Now, Luke says that Jesus himself appeared among them, but they didn't even notice. The text says that they were kept from recognizing him. But what does that mean? It doesn't mean that Jesus put on some type of disguise, that he was trying to veil himself from them. Jesus wasn't intentionally trying to do that. What it means is that it was their slowness of heart that kept them from seeing. It kept them from having eyes to truly see. The point is, and at this point in their journey, they were not capable of recognizing and embracing the resurrected Christ. They just didn't have eyes to see. And then there's this almost humorous exchange. Jesus approaches them, appears to them, and says, "What are you guys so worked up about?" And one of the disciples, whom Luke names as Cleopas, says, "Are you the only one who does not know what has happened during these days in Jerusalem? Are you the only one who doesn't know about these things?" And then Jesus says, "What things?" Do you see what Jesus is doing? Do you see how he is walking with them on this journey, leading them to name the source of their hopelessness? He could have just been like, "Pow, hey, I'm the resurrected Christ. Here's a miracle. Boom, here I am." But no, he's leading them to name. He knew. I mean, that's the irony. He was the only one who knew. He knew, but he wanted them to name the source of their hopelessness. The growth of resurrection hope begins at this place. Jesus does not ignore it. But what he wants to do is he wants in that place to preach a deeper and a truer gospel than they were telling themselves. So Cleopas responds, "What are these things? The things concerning Jesus the Nazarene." "He was great and all," Cleopas says, "but he didn't do what we had hoped that he would do." The disciples could not yet grasp the possibility of hope beyond their disappointment. The problem wasn't their disappointment. The problem wasn't the fact that they'd experienced loss. The problem was they could not grasp hope beyond it. Their vision then became completely dictated by their disappointment. They even knew that Jesus' body was missing. They couldn't believe the testimony of the women who said that an angel had told them that that meant that Jesus was alive. They'd read the prophets, they had spent time with Jesus, but they couldn't make the connection. They could not see the reality of resurrection that was right in front of them. Jesus says, "Oh, you foolish ones, slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken." Jesus is not saying here when he says, "Oh, you foolish ones," he's not saying that they're stupid or that they're moronic. He's saying you're just obtuse. You're slow to grasp. Slow to reorient your life, your desires on what is in front of you. Jesus was naming that they were slow to allow their will, the center of their being, their desires, the things that they loved the most, that they were slow to have that be refashioned by what was standing right in front of them. Slow of heart. And then Jesus pegs the central piece of their slowness. He says, "Was it not necessary that the Messiah suffer and then enter his glory?" Was it not necessary? And this question is crucial because suffering and death seem like, to these disciples, the most random, unnecessary, and defeating thing about all these things that have happened. And isn't that true for us? Isn't it true that the disappointment and the suffering and the loss seem to us often like the most random and defeating and unnecessary thing? But Jesus is saying, was it not necessary? They are slow of heart because they have not embraced the relationship between suffering and God's redemption. They hoped for the right things. They had hoped that Jesus was going to be the one to redeem Israel. But they were not yet able to connect their hope with the suffering. But this was key. And we see that it becomes key throughout the New Testament. Frequently throughout the New Testament, and it, especially in Paul, suffering gets connected to hope. In fact, Paul says that suffering produces hope. And this is the case. Suffering produces hope because Christ is risen. Suffering produces hope because we have a Messiah who suffered and died. He is risen, and he is redeeming all things. He is making all things new. But don't miss this. Don't miss this part. Even after Jesus unfolds this reality to them, it says that Jesus then interpreted the law, the Moses and the prophets, in light of himself. Even after Jesus illuminates this for them, they still didn't recognize him. Jesus walks with them, talks with them, interprets the entire Old Testament in light of himself. Basically, they got the best Bible study ever. And yet, Jesus is known to them as the resurrected Christ only in the breaking of the bread. The implication is that correct biblical knowledge, while necessary, is not sufficient. It is not sufficient to move them beyond their disappointment and slowness of heart into resurrection hope. And that means that if we're in that place of disappointment and slowness of heart, that we can know a whole lot of stuff, but still be completely motivated by our disappointment, still have no resurrection hope. We can exegete the text left and right, but still be despairing and have no resurrection hope, not live in light of the resurrection. They didn't just need a good Bible study, although this was important. They needed the risen Christ to reveal himself in the breaking of the bread. And then they needed to yield to it. And this breaking of the bread, is shorthand for table fellowship. When Jesus gathered with his disciples intimately, personally around the table. This was ordinary stuff for them. The disciples had probably had table fellowship, had probably broken bread with Jesus many times before. It was something that was very familiar to them. But we see also that Jesus does not force himself into this fellowship. Luke says that when they came to Emmaus, Jesus acted as if he was going farther, but the disciples urged him to stay. It seems that Jesus was waiting for the invitation, that he was waiting for the space to get real around the table. To get real in the most ordinary and personal and intimate places. So only after they slowed down, and were fully present in that most ordinary of moments, only after they entered into communion with Jesus there, only then did everything change. Did the light bulb come on? Only then could they say, "We're not our hearts burning within us," while he talked with us on the road. The effect of Jesus making himself known to them in the breaking of the bread is resurrection hope. "Holy cow," they say, "Christ really is with us. And he's been with us all along. God has been working his redemption all along." Resurrection hope transformed their slow hearts to burning hearts. And when they embrace this reality that the risen Christ is redeeming all things, their lives began to take on a new trajectory. They got up that night and returned to Jerusalem. And as we see that happens at the end of Luke and the beginning of Acts, they go out boldly and proclaim the resurrected Christ. Their lives take on a new trajectory. The risen Christ is making himself known to us on the journey of our deepest disappointments and loss. The risen Christ is making himself known to us on the journey of our deepest disappointments. Resurrection hope begins with the settled trust that Christ is risen and is redeeming all things, making all things new. Can you receive that today? That in the midst of your journey, of your deepest disappointments and loss, that God is making all things new and that Jesus is making himself known to you, redeeming all things. Can you receive that today? Receiving resurrection hope begins with this phrase that I'm going to kind of give to you. We had hoped. How would you finish that sentence? I had hoped that my life would turn out differently. I had hoped that I would be more successful. I had hoped that that job would be more fulfilling. I had hoped that my girlfriend wouldn't break up with me. I had hoped that I would have kids by now or be married by now. I had hoped that that person wouldn't be so frustrated with me. I had hoped. Resurrection hope begins there. The disciples said, we had hoped that Jesus would redeem Israel, but everything fell apart. Yes, but the falling apart is the point. And as long as we need to protect against disappointment and loss, we will not be able to participate in Jesus' resurrection work. Because fear will keep us from seeing what is there. Our disappointment will dictate the way that we see, and we won't be able to see it. But if the resurrected Christ is with us and he really is working redemption in all things, then it is safe to boldly return home to Jerusalem. It's safe to go back. We see that resurrection hope is not blind optimism. Blind optimism is just naive. It's naive to the disappointment. Resurrection hope, again, it doesn't need some type of fake certainty or some sort of emotional force of will. Resurrection hope is just about trust. Trust that God really has done and is doing the things that he says that he's going to do. The kind of trust that just puts yourself in the way of that. Resurrection hope speaks to our fear and anxiety, because it trusts that in the redemption and disappointment, or in God's redemption, that disappointment and loss actually lead to hope. Resurrection hope is able to say, yes, this is terrible right now. But Christ is risen, and God is making all things new. He is redeeming the world in Christ. And we can say, and we can trust. Resurrection hope trusts this. It trusts that even in the midst of these things, even these things do not disrupt God's ability to make life from death. We can't educate our way out of hopelessness. We can't fake our way out of hopelessness. We can't worry our way out. We can't manage or earn or fix our way out of hopelessness. All those things eventually will only lead to more despair. All we can do is learn to commune with the resurrected Christ as he makes himself known to us in the intimate, ordinary places of our lives. Where are those ordinary places for you? Is there an area of your life where Jesus is saying, I'm making myself known here? Can you receive it? I'm making myself known here, even in the midst of this. Can you receive it? Again, receiving resurrection hope begins with that phrase, we had hoped. It begins with our longing. So we bring our hopes, the things that we had longed for and were dashed, or are still longing for most in life, and we allow our longing to be fulfilled in Jesus. Jesus will do the work. We don't have to try really hard to squeeze out hope. All we have to do is put ourselves in the way of the resurrected Messiah. He will do the work, but we have to yield to him in the midst of our disappointment. We see that resurrection hope transforms the way that we see the world. It gives us the ability to see the world and to see our lives in light of the resurrection. So when we see circumstances, we see it in light of the reality that God is making all things new. And this is how it leads to resurrection living. Because when we look at our lives and we look at the world around us, what we see with is resurrection eyes. We don't see the things that lead to despair and disappointment and loss. We see those places where God is making all things new. Places of disappointment and hopelessness become sights. They become places where we realize that God was working redemption all along. And this emboldens us to be the type of witnesses on mission that God calls us to be. This actually transforms maybe what mission is about for us. Not trying harder to go out and do the things that God tells us to do, because if we don't, they won't happen. Mission becomes being a witness to the hope. Because we are so filled with the hope, because we have eyes to see that God is working redemption and new life in all these places, we're just going out and we're pointing that out. Saying, can you see that God is working new life in this place where it seems like that there's only death and loss? Recently, I took some time off. Some of you guys are thinking, I want to take some time off. My goal was to practice Sabbath. And that for me means just to stop. Practicing Sabbath means to stop. To stop producing, to stop working. That Sabbath was really hard for me. And it wasn't hard just because I have a difficulty stopping, which I do. It was hard because of what I found when I stopped. Once I stopped working and was just still long enough to listen, I was met with the disturbing reality that for various reasons, I was really disappointed. I hadn't even realized how disappointed I truly was. I thought that the Sabbath was going to be about finding tranquility and peace and all that fluffy stuff. But I just found disappointment. And there were some moments when I just felt hopeless. And I realized that so often I've been motivated by my disappointment. And when I'm motivated by my disappointment, I'm not able to get in on resurrection life. All I'm doing is trotting sullenly back to Emmaus. I have a lot to say, but my heart is slow. I'm learning that I can't run from my disappointment. I'm learning to trust that the disappointment is the place where Jesus has been working redemption all along. I'm learning that resurrection hope means, quite simply, that I cannot control the outcomes. Resurrection hope for me means that I have to trust that I cannot control the outcomes. And that's okay, because Christ is redeeming all things. I can simply step out and trust the reality with the confidence that God will do what he says he's going to do. That's what resurrection living looks like for me. Trusting that God is going to be who he says that he is. I'm learning that my job, that my mission, and by the way, your mission as well, is to just be a witness to hope. To witness to the reality that when and where everything seems lost in our life and in the world around us, God is working new life. That's what it looks like for us to be on mission. In all these places, Jesus is making himself known in the breaking of the bread, and he wants to transform my disappointment and your disappointment into resurrection hope. Can you receive that today? So every week we come to this breaking of the bread, to this table. And we come to this table, to this very almost extraordinary thing, because it symbolizes and it gathers together how Christ is making himself known to us in all the other ordinary places of our life. That's why this has force. Because what happens here, if we let it, will explode out into the rest of our lives. And we'll see that Jesus is making himself known to us in all those ordinary, intimate places in the rest of our lives. So I invite you to respond this morning. How will you respond this morning? I invite you to respond, maybe with the phrase, just maybe using this phrase, God, I had hoped that, fill in the blank. So I invite you to respond, to talk to God about that, and then to bring that to the table this morning. Let the cultivation of the resurrection hope start there in your life. So by God's grace, as we surrender to him in the breaking of the bread, may we continue to become people who are resurrection people. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.